Spring Black Friday savings are happening now at the Home Depot and also at your front door. Get spring savings delivered to you with free delivery on over 2 million items. Everything you need for spring cleaning, patio decorating, and front yard gardening sent right to you. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Spring your way with Spring Black Friday savings only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
Welcome to the Brandel's Chambly podcast with Jaime Diaz. Brandel, great seeing you. We don't see each other very much anymore, but there will come a time. In fact, next week at Wingfoot, we'll see each other. So I look forward to that.
Mostly on Zoom and at major championships, but I always enjoy sitting down and talking golf with you.
Thanks, Brandel. And well, let's talk about a lot of things today. We've got Wingfoot coming up, of course, the U.S. Open on a wonderful golf course with a lot of players with very interesting, good narratives coming into the event. But let's review briefly the FedEx Cup, which DJ put on a show. That was great. Randall, I know you have a thought about whether he should have got an official win out of that. He's won 23 as it is. Would it be 22, according to your definition, which I don't think is unreasonable. Go ahead and sound off.
There should definitely be an asterisk by his win total of 23. If they're going to continue on with this format, they need to do away with calling the finale the Tour Championship and just call it the FedEx Cup. He did not win the Tour Championship. He did not win a tournament. He went from 22 to 23 wins. He did not win the Tour Championship. Xander Schauffele won by 3 over Scottie Scheffler and by 4 over Dustin Johnson. So, you know, the format last year, I think, was vindicated by Rory winning, actually having the lowest score there. And it gave them sort of a 1 year reprieve from, I think, highlighting the flaws in the new system. You know, they've gone from having somewhat of a confusing finale and that a lot of people watching wouldn't immediately know who was winning to now having, I think, even more, competitive confusion in that nobody knows who won. They've gone from not knowing who's winning to nobody knows who won. Because, you know, I saw somebody post, you know, when Dustin Johnson's playing his best, nobody can beat him. And I thought, Xander Schauffele just beat him. Scottie Scheffler just beat him. It's like, stop it. It's like, you know, he had a phenomenal run. And if you want to, make the playoffs sort of this continuous tournament, you know, from one round to the next, to the next, to the next and on. Sure. You know, there has to be a better way of handicapping, and I've heard people say, you know, that the playoffs in other sports give home field advantage and buys. And that's certainly the case, but generally speaking, where they meet for the Super Bowl or the World Series is a neutral ground of sorts. Imagine if Usain Bolt were given a 5-yard head start because he'd had, or 5-meter head start because he'd had so much success in the preliminaries and he won by 1 meter. Would you say that he was the fastest runner in that last heat? No.
I agree. You know, I'm agreeing with you here. I do think the issue is just simply the Tour Championship. I don't have a problem with an official win for the cumulative series of events that DJ won in terms of the point system they had. And I wouldn't have a problem with him getting an official win from that, along with the other wins within it. However, I do think it is a misnomer to call the Tour Championship an official victory. If you're just, because it's not, if it's self-contained as a Tour Championship, he didn't shoot the lowest score. So I think it's right. A semantical PR issue. I think I'll bet you the tour deals with it. They have continued to refine the FedEx Cup. And I think in just about every case, they've improved it every time. And this might be the next improvement.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he doesn't have 23 wins. You know, he did win the FedEx Cup, but the way they have it now, I mean, the person, who wins the Tour Championship, for the most part, all, for the exception of 4 years out of 13, won the tour championship.
And as you know, the world golf, official world golf rankings does not give him an official win on that.
They gave Xander Schauffele.
It makes your argument. It definitely makes your argument.
Yeah. So it needs some work, and I'm well aware of trying to factor in the biases to reward, you know, good play over the course of the year and good play over the course of the playoffs. But they cannot continue to award a victory to the tour championship for players who don't win the tour championship. It's the first time in history, as far as I know, because it's ridiculous to consider it otherwise, that somebody's awarded a victory on the PGA Tour without winning the actual event.
You're piling on here, but effectively, I'm going to give you win the point, definitely.
I mean, it detracts from the fact that he has played extraordinary golf over the last four events. But
Well, let's talk about DJ a little bit, because this is just my bias without really breaking down a lot of metrics. Other than I know he's one of the greatest drivers statistically ever, and when he's on, very good through the bag. However, I just feel like he's putting so much better, starting with Hartford. And that might not even be reflected completely in the stats. I kind of look at a situational putting. When he's had to make a big putt, he's been making them. And I would say, and again, this is an intangible, his biggest flaw in terms of not winning when he was positioned to win in the past was not making big situational putts often enough. That might be unfair. That might be a bias. I may have incomplete information. It's just my impression. But I do think he's left me with a very strong impression that he's got a lot of confidence and solid technique and great, I think, memory bank right now from his recent success with the putter, and it's made him a different player.
Yeah, I think left unsaid and left underappreciated about Dustin Johnson is, you know, he did not come out on the PGA Tour fully formed the way Tiger Woods, Rory McIlroy, Jordan Spieth, John Rahm, just to name a few, did. When you start to look at Dustin Johnson, it's easy to see him as this, you know, future Hall of Fame player and maybe perhaps in the conversation of one of the greats of all time, but it misses the point that he came out and struggled. Now, he did win in his rookie year, but I think that, again, overlooks the fact that he was a completely different player then than what he became. You know, of the, okay, so he's, what is he, 27th on the all-time win list now with that victory at the Tour Championship. Mm-hmm. The 26 men in front of him, with few exceptions, were precocious talents. And those exceptions, as far as I can tell, are Hogan, Trevino, and Singh. Those players struggled early on. Trevino struggled not on tour. He wasn't even on tour.
Right, he couldn't get on tour, yeah.
But he was trying to work it out from basically 60 to 66, 67. Singh similarly struggled a little bit, and Hogan famously struggled. So DJ, you know, yes, he came out on tour as a marvelous driver of the golf ball, but his rookie year on tour, he was 134th in scoring average. He was 134th in the FedEx Cup. So if you look at what he, from his low point to his high point, in every aspect of the game other than driving, in strokes gained approach, his low point was 159. He's ascended to fifth around the greens. He was 192. He ascended to 23. Sand saves, 178. He's ascended to third. And scoring average from 134th to first. So, you know, there's these market improvements in his game along the way, you know, from 2011 to 2013, huge improvement in his iron play. 2015 to 2016, big improvement in his short game. So he's continued to get better. And it's, you know, it's not as inspiring, I suppose, as a Hogan or a Trevino or even a Vijay Singh story, but it is one of those stories. And when you look at him now, he's separated himself primarily with great iron play. That's the difference in this run. And in the quarantine or lockdown, you know, he reached out to a visual expert, Dr. Craig Farnsworth, and they did some work. And he's not just a visual guy. He's also, you know, very knowledgeable on putting. And they did a lot of work on his tempo of his stroke, on back through his setup, all kinds of things that made a huge difference from, you know, the way he was putting earlier in the year to the way he putted in the last half of the year. So it's cool to see, you know, it certainly, you know, I think watching Dustin Johnson play his best, John Rahm playing his best, if Rory could get back to the type of golf he was playing before the, you know, the quarantine, we have, you know, marvelous storylines going into the Open. But, you know, Rory is a bit of an if, you know. I think he's had a life-changing moment, and I think that's worthy of being distracted. The question is, can he, you know, find the form and the focus that that had him on track to have another great year? And that's a big if, but hopefully it comes to fruition at Wingfoot.
Okay, not to hit lightning rod points here intentionally or exploit them, but because there was a meme of you with Brooks Koepka, and I always like talking to you about Koepka. Unfortunately, you know, he's hurt, and he had to withdraw from the U.S. Open, and it probably, in retrospect, gives a lot of perspective to some of his poor play over this last, it's almost a year now. And so, you know, I wonder your thoughts in terms of the future. And we've seen players get hurt, and sometimes those injuries are chronic and they take away some special chemistry that is hard to put back together at times. Sometimes a guy comes right back, but it seems ominous to a guy who plays with as much physical force as he does to have a left knee injury. And I'm just wondering how you are evaluating what you've seen so far.
Yeah, first of all, with regard to the meme that's out there, it's pretty funny. Somebody put together a picture of me with my wife where I was pointing at the back of her caddy bib where she was actually caddying for me. It had my name on it, but they've photoshopped my name out of it and put on there, Brooks isn't hurt, he's scared. And, you know, people are sending it to me and I see the comments and people actually think I would have done that. I think it's funny, given the fact that, you know, Brooks Koepka has been so chippy towards me and other players. But no, I wouldn't have done that. But it's funny. But it's getting a nice run on social media. You know, there's a lot to take in with Brooks Koepka. The dangers of surrounding yourself vigorous physical trainers. You know, I mean, look, Tiger got hurt, and I'm convinced he got hurt in the gym. And maybe his, you know, high thrill theatrics, jumping out of planes, whatever, contributed to it as well. But Jason Day's hurt. Rory McIlroy got hurt. Brooks Koepka's hurt. Dustin Johnson's hurt. What do all of them have in common is that they were, you know, all taking a page out of Tiger's book and exhausting themselves in the gym to no end. So, you know, I mean, while I've been critical of a lot of the work they've done in the gym, you know, Rory corrected it. Jason Day is going to suffer for the rest of his career, likely, because of the injuries. It's, you know, I mean, the game is trying to figure out how to grow as a sport. You know, these guys are going to learn to train better. You know, the better understanding of how to train for golf is going to, you know, evolve, but they've hurt themselves in the gym, and it's hurting them in their primes. You know, I mean, there's the window is short, you know, you're from 25 to 35. It's a blink of an eye, and it's really 25 to 33. It's just a blink of an eye. And you can't get those majors back. You can't get the opportunities back. So, you know, what I've read is his left knee and his left hip. And, you hope that he corrects the way he trains and that he gets healthy again. Cause it's fun to watch him play. There's no question about that, but, But I think, going beyond the injury, I think the things that Brooks Koepka said at the PGA Championship have had an impact on the way Dustin Johnson's played. You know, when he, and I would just say, disrespected Dustin Johnson with his comments at the PGA Championship, saying, you know, what has he won? You know, just one major championship. He talks, Brooks Koepka, about wanting respect, but then doesn't give respect when it's warranted. And, you know, I would say that this is the danger with golf becoming more of a sport. You know, golf is, the very best golfers have always handled themselves with the utmost respect to the traditions of this game, but also to the highest reaches of sport. You know, sport isn't just about winning. It's about learning to compete in an ethical and reciprocal nature. It's why we reserve our highest respect for athletes who not only demonstrate excellence in a skill, but also excellence of character. Bobby Jones, Jackie Robinson, Roberto Clemente, Arthur Ashe, Muhammad Ali, Roger Staubach, Wayne Gretzky. You know, there's a high order ethic of skill, but also of reciprocity with all of those athletes. So, I understand the game being more of a sport now and bringing more of a sports mentality to the game and trash talking. And it's not going to probably leave the game, but, and I'm sure as the game becomes more a venue for gambling, that this kind of trash talking will become more part of the sport, but it doesn't mean that the sport's better off because of it.
Yeah, I would just say, I think, honestly, there's a risk in trash talking in golf, because it is an internal game to a large extent, and the opponent really isn't the other player usually, it's the golf course, and you've got to be, I think,
yourself, yeah,
completely focused, and if you know you're carrying a burden of, I got to live up to what I just said, that's probably an unnecessary burden. Maybe some guys react well to it. My guess is that it added pressure. Even the Brooks, who's obviously a pretty tough guy and seems to welcome, you know, being the lightning rod again, who everybody's either pulling for or pulling against. But, I think he might temper that in the future. I don't think it's a percentage play, so to speak, in terms of being at peak performance. The other thing, I thought it was notable that Jason Day kind of warned, and again, without a lot of, you know, firsthand information other than anecdotally and what he sees and his own experience, warned Bryson DeChambeau to be careful with the training that he's doing. It's so extreme that he's going to have back problems. Again, everybody's different. Bryson is pretty sophisticated about, I think, doing the kind of injuries that won't put too much pressure on the wrong places in his body. My guess is he vets everything pretty carefully. I'm not saying he's, you know, without the ability to make an error, but I think he knows he's taking a big risk here if he doesn't handle it right, and I'm guessing he's being very careful. However, to your point, historically now, guys who have lifted heavy have probably gotten hurt more often than players from previous primes who weren't nearly in as good a shape in terms of body fat and, you know, aerobic capacity and all kinds of things that we measure in major athletics. But in golf, I mean, I don't ever know Colin Montgomery ever getting hurt. Just to pull a name out of the hat, you know.
Look,
as Azinger says, you can't pull fat. Sorry, Colin, you know, but I mean, he has that nice, soft, approach to hitting the golf ball as far as his body and the fluidity. And not saying that's optimum, it's not, but it is a way probably towards longevity. So, all these things you're saying, I think, are, you know, unresolved but very legitimate talking points going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fitness. You know, what I like about Bryson DeChambeau's work is it has resulted in an improvement and there's an obvious before and after. You can't say that with Tiger Woods about his fitness. You can't say that with Brooks Koepka about his fitness. You cannot say that about Dustin Johnson and his fitness. They all swung faster when they were skinnier. Mm-hmm. Less obvious, Scott Stallings. A huge physical transformation. Yeah. He swung faster when he wasn't sinewy or when he was not ripped. Right. You go look at his clubhead speed from before he was ripped and after he was ripped, and it's deteriorated as he's gotten ripped. Yeah. You know, he pops up on the screen. Everybody's like, you know, he's a great fit, blah, 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 he's better. No, wrong. He may look better. He may be healthier.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't serve a utility in terms of getting better. Same with Rory. Rory, his new training regimen, you could argue, has made him longer. And I think that's why you pay attention to those that made changes in the way they train and they got better. And so I think it's worthy of studying what Rory did to get longer post his injury and what Brooks Koepka has done. And I'm pretty bullish on Brooks, or not Brooks, excuse me, on Bryson, having done his due diligence on the proper way to train. I think he would have left no stone unturned. I don't think he would have blindly taken the advice of a trainer without doing his research. So
and paying attention to how he's feeling as well. Well, it, probably, you know, obsessive detail. Yeah.
And again, in one particular area, which is a fairly important area, it made him a dominant force off of the tee. He still has a long way to go, becoming anywhere near the player that a Dustin Johnson or a John Rahm is. I mean, Bryson's a fine player, but he's not in their league. His iron play needs a lot of work. The same thing that makes you, or that may make you, a really long driver of the golf ball is not the thing that makes you a great iron player.
I've heard internally he's getting some persuasive argument to go to a regular length wedge or a shorter wedge at least. And again, that's not a new idea, but I've heard that it's getting closer to home. So
yeah, I don't think that would have any difference whatsoever.
I'm not saying it's the problem, but
right. But I don't know why, that's beside the point. It's the technique.
It's a 6-iron length wedge.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's the technique that matters, it's just the technique. You know, he's not particularly good with a 6-iron anyway. It's his iron play in general that he struggles with. And that's related to the method that he uses. I mean, he, in the same way he's tackled hitting better drivers, he could tackle hitting better iron shots and go investigate who the best iron players are. And I'm convinced Bryson could figure that out along with his coach and blend in the elements of great iron play with great driving.
Maybe that's the next mission. Just briefly on Bryson, but let's transition to Wingfoot. How do you think the experiment will play out on a probably as rigorous a U.S. Open test as there is in terms of especially punishing crookedness at all? Expect anything from him, or do you think that his method, or at least his approach, can be something that actually works at Wingfoot as well?
No, I mean, if you look at 2006, I mean, one, that was the first year of graduated rough, but also if you go back and watch the U.S. Open final, which you can do on YouTube, you could see that a lot of the places that Phil Mickelson was missing it were trampled down by the gallery. And that's not going to happen this go around. So not only will there not be graduated rough, there'll be, from what I understand, thicker rough, but there will not be the escape the deeper you get into the rough, because it's trampled down. So you're going to pay a stiff penalty for a miss there. At least I hope you do. I think the experiment that was graduated rough, it lasted from 2006 to 2018. Personally, I think it was a huge failure. In terms of what the U.S. Open has always meant, and in my opinion, should mean. And I think this, I think Pebble Beach aside, to me, this is welcoming back our national open. This is what, I can't imagine a better venue. Okay, maybe you could argue Oakmont, but I couldn't imagine a better venue for a U.S. Open than Wingfoot under, the difficulty of those green complexes, every one of which gets your full attention. And then add to that the difficulty of the design and the setup. And I think that's exactly what a U.S. Open should be. So, you know, you're going to have to drive it straight. You're not going to get away with you know, hitting. Phil Mickelson stood on the 18th tee in the 2006 U.S. Open, having hit 23 of 55 fairways, and he had a one-shot lead.
And he had two that day, as you know. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, Sandy Tatum, who was, you know, on the executive committee for the USGA and famously defended the severity of the setup in 1974, he had to be, you know, he had to be apoplectic about what was going on there. So I'm really looking forward to this. You know, you start to look at straighter drivers of the golf ball, and it's, you know, there's not many of them that are elite drivers. You know, there's Webb Simpson. He's not an elite driver, but he'll be an elite driver that week. There's
Colin Morikawa.
Colin Morikawa. There's John Rahm. Right. So, you know, there would be a reordering. You know, if you want to win the U.S. Open, it should be like this, and it will send a message to those in the game. If you want to win the national championship of the United States, one of the four major championships, you got to drive the ball better, which is to say, straighter.
Yeah. No, I think that's something that the U.S. Open has always been, had always been, and I think the USGA realized, let's go back to the future here, because that's our distinctive quality. And, you know, I was reading a pretty ominous story of the superintendent at Wingfoot. He's kind of chanting to himself, according to the reporter, eight over as a winning score, I guess, because the rough is really thick. And as you said, that's a great point about Mickelson. People forget. I do recall, especially coming down the stretch, he was sitting in near trees, and there was gallery, and also around the tree, probably not as much sunlight. So the rough was not as thick. And even on 18, when he blew it into the tent and it rolled down, he was essentially on dead grass. It wasn't that hard a lie. So not to say Phil wasn't a magician that day, but he would have been less of one had there been the kind of rough we're going to see this year, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, from 2006 to 2018, the average of the winner in driving accuracy was 28th. The 13 years that preceded that, it was 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it weren't for graduated rough, you could make an argument that Cabrera in 2007, Woods in 2008, Spieth in 2015, and Koepka in 2018 would not have won the U.S. Open. They don't win the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm.
Where they finished in driving accuracy in those weeks doesn't win a U.S. Open. It did in this more forgiving era, but not a minute too soon. I think they've abolished that philosophy.
Yeah, there was an announcement yesterday, as you know, at Pinehurst, where they're going to go to Pinehurst five times between now and 2047. But unstated, but definitely true, is that they're going to go to fewer places. And the places they're going to go are going to be, you know, traditional golden age type places like Oakmont and Pebble Beach. And those two in particular, almost as much as Pinehurst, and then Shinnecock and Wingfoot, and not many others are going to fit in. It's going to be a smaller rota, and I think it is going to be towards the old Hogan model of the U.S. Open, which is welcome, I think, because I think that was the USGA's distinction. That was the test. I loved Harding. It was great. I mean, the spectacle of it. It's not a U.S. Open, in my opinion, quality golf course. It's a very nice golf course. It looked wonderful on TV, and it was a great tournament and a great winner. But the U.S. Open is a level above in terms of difficulty in that setup. And I look forward to it once a year at least. I even like what Olympia Fields did. I thought that was, you know, a welcome variation from what we've been seeing. And you know, putting pressure on the driver, I think, is a constructive thing right now in the game. I know that's something that's another discussion, but that you favor in terms of the best way to combat sort of the distance explosion.
Well, it's just a strategy of philosophy versus a strategy of playing the hole. I'll give you a, and I know you and I differ on this, but let me just say this. So, you know, there is a large group of people in the game. I don't know that it's huge, but a large group of people in the architectural world argue for less rough and no trees because it encourages attacking lines of play angles. Mm-hmm. And I would argue with them that narrow fairways and thick rough requires a type of strategy as well. So let's play this out. So Seve Ballesteros, Phil Mickelson, do you think they're any better at divining out or figuring out a strategic way to play golf holes than Bobby Jones was or Jack Nicklaus or Ben Hogan? No. I mean, they played well at Augusta National, which is steeped in the maxims of no rough, large options, and great angles. But so did Hogan and Nicklaus. Mm-hmm. And then you look at what Phil and Seve did in the U.S. Open. Neither of them won one. And then you look at what Jones, Hogan, and Nicklaus did, all of which won four. And you think, who would have spent more time solving the problems that it takes to control a golf ball? So, you know, those that favor no rough, no trees, they want to encourage bold lines of play towards good angles. But I say that where there is no penalty, then you do take bold lines of play towards angles. But when there is a severe penalty, you take bold strategies to figure out how you can, with some assurance, find the best line of play. So you think about the game harder. Are there any great books on the golf swing written by Seve or Phil? Have you read one? No, they don't exist.
I have a couple, but they're not great.
Not on the golf swing.
Yeah, they're Seve.
Not on the golf swing. Yeah. On scrambling.
No, I have one on Seve's golf swing too, but it's
right. Yeah, like I said, great
hodgepodge.
And conversely, it's not hard to find great books on the golf swing by Jones, Hogan, or Nicklaus. Not hard at all. I believe they would have thought a lot harder about how to solve the problems of the game. Now, if the U.S. Open didn't exist, if every major championship were like the Masters, it wouldn't encourage the deep thinking that it takes to solve the problems of control. So, again, this goes back to Sandy Tatum's question or retort to the severity of the 19. We're trying to identify the best players in the world. And I think, yes, you want to identify somebody who can figure out how to play the best hole from a strategic standpoint, but you also want to identify those who can figure out how to play the game at its highest level, at its highest reaches from a strategic standpoint through a superior technique. So that's what the U.S. Open is to me. It's about asking the most questions about who the best player in the world is. So I agree with the comments of Sandy Tatum. I think there is room for every level of major championship. And I think we had that and we have that in the Masters and the Open. And now it sounds to me like we're returning to what the U.S. Open used to be, which is the most thorough examination of golf in the game. And so that's what I'm really looking forward to.
Bring on spring projects with Spring Black Friday Savings from The Home Depot. With free delivery on over 2 million items, you can bring on the spring cleaning, the patio decorating, and the front yard gardening. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Bring on the spring doing and spring your way only at The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
You know, I agree with almost everything you said there. I think Phil is a great thinker about the game, given that he has made the decision that he wants to play an aggressive game without superior technique. I think he's made the calculation. It's too hard to change my technique and make it really a solid ball control type game. And I'm going to try to play with boldness and use my short game and the skills I have and figure it out some way. And the fact that he's finished second six times in the U.S. Open, to me, is a miracle. And it shows some kind of great course management and of his own styling. I don't think he's a mindless player, and I'm not saying you're saying that either. It might look random the way he plays, but I think it's well thought out. He just doesn't have the technique to control the ball like the U.S. Open demands. And having said all that, I do think it's a good measure of who the best player is to hit a driver in the fairway when there's rough on both sides. That, you know, the freedom is gone at that point. You've got to make a good golf swing knowing the penalty is high. And that changes the whole mentality of that shot, unless you're a genius at just putting yourself in a trance and ignoring what's around you completely. But knowing there's rough and it's a half stroke penalty to go in there, that's pressure. And to do that over 72 holes, to me, just that ability to keep driving in the fairway over and over, that alone almost makes you the best player. It doesn't totally, but is it a head start. And that's the guys that have won the U.S. Open traditionally.
Yeah. Well, that's a Colin Morikawa type of player.
Right. I like it.
You know, I'm if the USGA is setting the U.S. Open up this year the way it's been rumored, then, you know, I applaud them. So,
yeah. Any impressions of Wingfoot yourself? Played it? Did you play in 97 PGA? I apologize.
Yeah, I did. I did, not well, but I've played there a number of times. And I think it's, I talked about this earlier from a green complex standpoint. It could be the finest set of green complexes, certainly of a Parkland golf course anywhere in the world. You know, it is, if you read Tom Doak's comments about Wingfoot, he says that it's analogous to sort of a clay soil Pinehurst. Now, it doesn't have the same sort of soil as Pinehurst, so it can't play quite the same, but it's from a design standpoint in that ilk of golf courses. You know, number one might be, and is argued by some golf course architects to be, the finest green complex in the world. And then, you know, as I said, every green complex is pretty interesting, and it's got the hardest opening hole in golf, in all of golf, is the first hole. The hardest closing hole in all of golf is the 18th hole. That certainly was the case in 2006. They were the hardest opening and closing holes in all of golf. And in between there were scores of holes that were amongst the hardest holes in the game as well. So it's almost like the opposite of St. Andrews in that regard. You think of St. Andrews, which starts you easy and finishes you easy. This one, you know, just slaps you awake and then beats you up before you get to the 19th hole.
Yeah.
You know, and we certainly saw that in 2006, is it, you know, it crumbled great talents, not just Phil, but Furyk, Colin Montgomery as well. I mean, these are formidable talents that stumbled there. So I'm looking forward to, you know, you think about this. So they've played five U.S. Opens there. The 353 of the 54 hole leaders, so the men who are presumably playing the best, shot 79 on Sunday.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, there was in 2006, there were two players tied for the lead, and they shot 76, 74 respectively. And then, you know, there was another 74 by Casper who was leading. So, you know, the golf course is an enigma to the best players in the world. And you could say that the combination of the design, the rough, and the U.S. Open pressure is too much for even the best players in the world to figure out. But I think that's what makes it's so compelling to watch.
I aesthetically, I think it's a masterpiece. I loved, I probably played six rounds there, and I've just loved, as you say, the green complex is from the fairway. You just feel like, man, I've got to hit a shot here, because this thing
right.
just shaped in such a way, it'll only accept a certain type of shot. And it tells you in a beautiful way, you know, Tillinghast was a real artist. I think that 79 and over, or that those finishing scores by 54 hole leaders, it is a pressure, you know, intensive golf course coming home. And Jones in 1929, he tripled the eighth hole. He had a big lead. He tripled the eighth hole. Then he tripled the 15th hole. And he was just, you know, leaking oil like crazy and made a 12 footer for par, which until Tiger made his putt at Torrey Pines, probably was considered the greatest putt ever because of everything that had come before and how ragged his mind must have been at that moment. But he sucked it up and made it. So Winfoot has this capacity for great drama. And Tillinghast was an exceptional, you know, I know you use the term architecture geek. I'm not a geek because I just don't know enough, but I just know what I like sometimes. But Tillinghast was truly a compelling figure, really brilliant, wonderful writer. Great insights, crazy, very much an excessive personality, you know, spent money too much, drank too much, married too many times, all those things. But, you know, he really had discipline and constraint when he put his courses together. One thing he said, I think I will always adhere to my old theory that a control shot to a closely guarded green is the surest test of any man's golf. He said many other things, but I always think of that because his approach shots are so beautiful, so demanding.
Right. That's a fabulous quote, yeah.
I think it is the best. I honestly think it's the best golf course in America for testing the best players. And also from the aesthetic sense that it's not just a grind. It really is beautiful, and it really inspires these guys to create shots. It's going to be harder to create shots from the rough, obviously, this week. But I just think we're in for the epitome of what a U.S. Open is about this week, this next week.
You're not going to get any argument from me on any of that. You know, I couldn't agree more.
Let's talk about something. By the way, did you? I'm sure you've run across Jackie Burke many times. Did you know Dave Marr by any chance?
Not well.
Okay.
I was a fan from afar, certainly read.
Right. Well, you guys would have been, you know, I knew Dave. I was very fortunate to know Dave, you know, a little, and he was a wonderful raconteur, very much like you. You guys were similar in a lot of ways. You would have had some great conversations. He was a great thinker about the game and wonderful phrase maker, really a great entertainer without ever being, you know, flamboyant about it. People just ended up listening when he talked because it just made sense, and it had poetry in it also. But he was an assistant at Winfoot under Claude Harmon. And I guess Jackie Burke was an assistant. I don't know if it was before Claude or after Claude. So Winfoot also produces this great golf culture of really knowledgeable people. And I think part of it is because they play that golf course so often. They just learn about the game. I want to talk, I'm sorry, that's just a little aside, but.
No, it's great aside.
There was a story in golfchannel.com today. We're taping on Thursday. And it was about Billy Casper and Arnold Palmer. And I asked you to read it, a little too much short notice. But I thought we'd talk about it. Billy Casper, of course, won the 59 U.S. Open at Winfoot. It was his first major. He won two others. And the second one he won was the 1966 U.S. Open at Olympic Club. And that's famous, of course, for Arnold Palmer having a seven-shot lead on the final nine holes. And by the 71st hole, 17th hole, it was all gone. So they came to the 18th hole, and Arnold pulled his drive into deep rough on the left. It's not a long hole, but it's tight. Casper was down the middle and ended up hitting to about 12 feet. Arnold very heroically actually gouged it out of the rough and got himself a 45-footer from above the cup. Lagged that down to about 5 feet above the cup still. And in that year, they had continuous putting, which many people don't remember, but you were able to putt out mandatorily as long as you were in nobody's line. In this case, he was going to stand close to Casper's line. So he asked Billy Casper, and these two guys were friends and had been and played a lot together, not close friends, but certainly respected competitors, respectful competitors. And Arnold asked Billy, what would you like me to do? And he said, well, Arnold, you're warm. Why don't you go ahead? Which when I read about that, and it's not really that well known, that quote.
No, he said, go ahead while you're hot.
Go ahead while you're hot. Excuse me. There's two ways of saying it. One is you're warm.
While you're hot.
Yeah, but while you're hot's even better. And so Palmer, you know, took that in, I guess, and made the putt, and later said that's one of the greatest pressure putts he ever made. Kind of like what Jones did. Unfortunately, he lost the playoff the next day. All right, and this is a long preamble, but Casper missed his putt. In any event, Casper, I asked him about this in 2012. I did a very nice interlude with him where was very nice to write a story on him. And I asked him about that moment. He said, you know, it was just a competitive moment, and I didn't mean anything by it. Okay, so I didn't even put it in the story. All right, so in 2012, I guess, at that same time, a biography was being written about Billy. And at that moment, one of the contributors was going to be his doctor, his personal doctor, who he went to see. The doctor told Billy, look, I'm sorry you have this blood disease. It's something we can't seem to ever stop, and you only have a few months to live probably. And Billy said, well, I've got to see Arnold. And this was a surprise to the doctor. The doctor was a good friend. His name's Dr. Rick Parkinson. He wrote this story on golfchannel.com. And he didn't know what he was talking about. Why do you have to see Arnold? Billy told him, I've always regretted what I said to him on the 18th hole at Olympic on Sunday. And the story then goes on to unfurl what happened between Billy Casper and Arnold Palmer when they did finally see each other and Billy could, you know, take this weight off his shoulders. So I was wondering, from your perspective as a player, you know, I'm sure a lot of things get said that fans don't hear. When is the line crossed, and did Billy cross it in saying that, or was it simply something that a competitor has to be able to absorb even if there is gamesmanship intended? Is that something that as a player, you're prepared to not just overcome, but perhaps even with greater determination, respond to?
Well, I think the fact that it bothered Billy all those years, you know, speaks to the kind of man that Billy was, which, you know, I mean, it is a widely held view that he's one of the classiest people, most humble superstars that the game has ever had. But also that he knew he crossed the line. If somebody had said something similar to me in a similar circumstance and I was in Arnold Palmer's shoes, yeah, I'd be, you know, I'd think that's gamesmanship, you know. I would probably be a little put off by it. And you know, I mean, would Bobby Jones have said that? I mean, would Bobby Jones have said something like that? Would Jack Nicklaus have said something like that? Would Tom Watson have said something like that? No, they wouldn't have. I mean, that, you know, as I read that story, it became clear, and I didn't know this really about Billy Casper, was that he was, you know, he was like a modern day Matt Kuchar, you know, mm-hmm. He liked to throw the needle out there a little bit, or maybe even a Phil Mickelson, but I don't think Phil would have ever said anything like that in competition. Phil in friendly back and forth games, you know, Phil's got the needle out from the first tee to the 18th green and on into the 19th hole. And that's fun. That's fun to play with buddies doing that. But for a major championship, I think that crossed the line. But I mean, it wasn't egregious. It just, it got up to it and tiptoed across the line. But it's not often. A new story in the game, is it? You know, it's not often that happens, that you know, that we learn something new about an event that all of us know so well, and a player or two players that we know well from a competitive standpoint, what we thought we knew very, very well. But you know, when you're out there, things happen. I mean, nothing along those lines, but I can tell you that something that bothered me for a long part of my career was I got invited to play in the eBay match play 1989 in Deauville, France, you know, on the English Channel. There were several other Americans that got invited to go play in this, Don Pooley being one of them, Dillard Pruitt, who's a tour official and just retired, and was a very good friend of mine. got invited to play. My team won the Pro-Am, but they didn't have the Pro-Am dinner until Friday night on the eve of the semifinals. And Dillard and I were set to play each other in the semifinals of the EBEL match play. And we went to the Pro-Am party where I was awarded, you know, whatever, however many francs for my team winning in a huge bottle of cognac, which I brought back to the table. And then Dillard and I sat there and drank along with a few other people at our table. We drank the whole bottle of cognac.
Oh, man.
And now Dillard and I had these massive suites that they had given us with these big bay windows overlooking the English Channel. And this was, believe it or not, it was a Russian-themed party at a French event. So go figure. And scores of people spilled back to the hotel, and they all ended up in Dillard's room, and we were having a nice party, listening to music, looking at the English Channel. And Dillard said, he pulled this Forward out of his bag, this Wood Brothers, if you remember those clubs.
Yeah, I had a couple of drivers.
Wood Brothers Forward, this gray-blue finish on it that was gorgeous. And he said, you know, I can't hit this thing the way I want to. And Dillard was notoriously a straight player. He hit it so straight. He said, I just can't hit this doggone thing, you know? I said, let me see that Forward. I said, let me see it. So I'm gripping it. I'm looking at it. And I just flung it out the window. And it just goes. And Dillard and I both lean out, watch this thing disappear into the abyss because we're on the high levels of this hotel. We thought it was hilarious, or at least I thought it was hilarious. I said, I fixed it for you. You'll never miss it again. So anyway, I went home, went back to my room, went to bed. You know, early in the morning, I hear this like that. And I go over and look through the peephole, and there's Dillard. And I open up the door, and I was like, Dillard, did I throw your Forward out the window last time? He goes, yes, you did. I said, well, let's go look for it. He goes, I've looked for it. I can't find it anywhere. And I was like, man, I'm sorry, you know. And so in our match, he needed that Forward by my count at least three times, and I beat him one up. So I felt terrible forever about throwing his Forward out the window. But fast forward years later, I'm still on tour. He's become a rules official. I get to the last hole at the AT&T on Saturday, which was the ninth hole at Poppy Hills for me. And I needed to make par to make the cut. And I hit it way right, hit a terrible tee shot, clattered around in the trees. I walk up there, the ball's gone, can't find it. Some fan comes over and he goes, your ball was right on the OB line. It was right there. And a fan came by, a spectator came by, picked it up and ran off with it. So I was like, well, this is complicated rules. So
yes.
I call for a ruling. And it was Dillard Pruitt's first week as a rules official. And he drives up. And he parks his cart, he's getting out, and he's walking over to me. And I said, hey, Dillard, before I tell you what happened, I never told you how sorry I am I threw your Forward out the window. And Dillard starts laughing. And sure enough, as I tell him the circumstances about the ruling I need, he's like, you know, this is far too complicated. And he goes, I feel somewhat biased. So he had to call. He ended up calling somebody else to come give the ruling. It was Mike Shea, who was.
Yeah, I remember Mike. Yeah.
Mike cut you no slack. I love Mike, great guy, but cut you no slack. And I thought, oh, this is Doom City here. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, things happen in competition along the way that you regret, you know, later. You know, I can remember early on, you know, Tom Lehman and I having a few words with each other on a Nike Tour event. And then years later, when he's named Ryder Cup captain and it's my job to interview him on TV, you know, we go back and we revisit that in a sort of friendlier way. You know, time sort of, you know, solves, is a salve on some wounds in the heat of competition. But it was a marvelous story, nonetheless. It was beautifully written. I really enjoyed the story, and it's worth a read. You know, if you have any sense of history, it's a wonderful read. And I think it captures the essence of not only Billy Casper, but also the beauty of this game.
And I think Arnold Palmer too comes off wonderfully. But I don't want to give away the ending.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we kind of already knew that about Arnold Palmer. You know, I think one of my favorite Arnold Palmer stories along those lines is he asked somebody if an irregularity on the green was a ball mark. In other words, if it were a spike mark or a torn up piece of grass from the foot, he wouldn't have been entitled to repair it. And whoever it was said, looked at him and said, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. And Arnold looked at him as sternly as he could and said, I don't want the benefit of the doubt. You know, and again, that speaks to who Arnold Palmer was as a competitor. Just again, you know, that's why we reserve our highest respect for not only athletes with great skill, but with great competitive character.
Yeah. That story appealed to me because it was always a mystery. And I thought it was a mystery solved in a really satisfying way. And the other thing is, you know, the subtext of Casper's life was that he came up hard. He came up with parents that in some ways sort of abandoned him. And he was living as a, you know, 11, 12 year old with friends and other relatives. So he had issues. And, you know, this story, I think, with great sensitivity, points out how some of those things made him a complicated character. He was a very tough competitor, and he was capable of putting the needle in, as you say. He didn't like it about himself, I think, later in life as he softened. But probably while he was doing it, it was just part of the way those guys played, especially in the 50s and 60s. So I just thought it was a great window into what it takes competitively to be a great player, but also how it's a double-edged sword. And sometimes it's qualities that you don't necessarily like about yourself that make you a winner. And you've talked about that. I know when you were playing a lot a couple of years ago or last year, you know, you said, you know, I don't really like myself that much when I'm getting ready to play in a tournament, because it does, right? It raises the level of intensity and selfishness and all sorts of things, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, golf is it's a selfish endeavor, and to be great at sport, you know, requires an inner level of arrogance that if you're, you know, not careful, that demon can get out. And you know, the next thing you know, there's, you know, it's celebrity entitlement syndrome kind of thing. You know, it gets out and pervades your life outside of the sport. And, you know, that's no way to be.
Yeah, and wrapping up, let's celebrate that NBC is back doing the U.S. Open. And our producer, Kaz, was careful to point out that the theme song from Yanni's Celebration of Man will be back. And I'm not going to hum it, but you'll recognize it. It'll be the ABC song for the U.S. Open. So there's going to be some nostalgia just kicking off the broadcast. But I think... everyone at Golf Channel, I know, is really happy about being connected with USGA's championships again, especially the U.S. Open.
Yeah. And well, Golf Channel is uniquely, and NBC, uniquely positioned, I think, to cover our national championship in as comprehensive a way as I would imagine the USGA would dream of. So it is nice. I mean, I think that, you know, there were a number of great innovations that I think Fox brought to golf television and some fabulous voices. But I think from a comprehensive standpoint, going back to the days when we used to do golf's longest day and cover, mm-hmm. you know, from the qualifying for the U.S. Open to, you know, the conclusion of play in the U.S. Open, we're very well positioned to cover the sport. And cover our national championship in a wonderful way. So, you know, I'm looking forward to being a part of the U.S. Open coverage. You know, and I think now that, you know, NBC is back to doing it, we'll have more access to stories and highlights, and that'll make the live from show even more compelling, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Really looking forward to seeing you in just a few days here.
Yes, and, I'm headed up there Saturday. So
yeah, me too. Let's right.
Perfect.
We pass our COVID test and life goes on.
Exactly.
In a privileged way right now, because anybody getting to see live golf is a rare being right now. So I'm looking forward to it because of the tournament and because of the site and just because of the rarity of the moment. So thank you, Brandel, and
thanks for listening. Always a pleasure, honey. See you up at the U.S. Open. Travel safe, and thanks to everybody who, for listening.
Yes, sir. All right. Take care, everyone. So long.
Cheers.
With Spring Black Friday deals at the Home Depot, you can give your lawn or garden beds a pop of color and protection. Right now, get a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10. Help your soil retain moisture longer with color that lasts up to 12 months. Shop Spring Black Friday deals for a special buy on Scott's Earth Grow Mulch, 5 bags for just $10 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done. Color selection varies by store. Limit 60 bags per customer while supplies last.